civil servant. Deluxe imitation wood grain paneling covered the walls, and a computer and phone that were only 10 years out of date sat atop the wood grain painted on steel desk, right behind a nameplate which read Director Brittany Ryan. "No," Britt, the much elder, said into her phone. "I've made my decision. Absolutely not." She winked at Britt the elder and smiled. Britt the Elder thought that Britt the Much Elder's voice sounded similar to her own, but slightly higher pitched and more nasal, like an audio recording of her own voice played back and sounding like a different person. Britt the Much Elder really sounded like Britt the Younger, but less whiny. She looked much the same as Britt the Elder, or Britt the Younger for that matter, with the same face, same build, and same reddish-brown hair. Instead of the retro-hip horn-rimmed glasses the younger two Brits preferred, Britt the Much Elder wore a pair of frameless spectacles. And instead of a light blue wizard robe or a flowing tropical weight dress, Britt the Much Elder wore a highly structured suit with a knee-length skirt. Britt the Much Elder said, "I understand all of that, and my decision stands. You are to keep the subject under surveillance, but do not move on him under any circumstances. Is that clear?" She listened for a few seconds to the barely audible squawking noise of the other person talking, before cutting them off. "You have your orders, Agent. That will be all. And, Agent, try not to fall for the banana in the tailpipe." She broke into a wide grin, almost laughing as she ended the call and placed her phone on the table. "I transferred those two doofuses to my task force so I could keep an eye on them, since they knew too much, but man, they've been worth it just for the entertainment value." Britt the Elder was not amused. She knew from the beginning that conferring with Britt the Much Elder was the simplest, most practical, and most logical thing to do. The fact that she tried several other things first demonstrated how unpleasant she found the prospect. She had also gone to talk to Jeff, as he had experience tampering with the code of living things, but he'd been very careful to leave their memories and other brain functions alone. All she learned from the visit was that Roy was not subtle about it when he took an interest in a woman. Britt the Much Elder leaned back into her desk chair. She smirked at Britt the Elder and raised her eyebrows playfully. "Sorry I had to be such a hard-ass just then. It goes with all this, I'm afraid." She waved her right hand in the air to signify the office, her title, and the job that gave her both of those things. Britt the Elder cleared her throat. "I was just asking you if you remember any of this happening from back when you were me." Britt the Much Elder nodded. "Yeah, that's right. And I don't. It got a lot harder to keep track of our life events after I took off and became Britt the Much Elder. Britt the Younger's only met me once, so her journals are no help. You don't keep a journal at all, and you barely ever see me anyway, so there isn't a pre-written record of what's going to happen to me from day to day. I tried to work from memory for a while, but then I just sort of let it go. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me. I've learned to enjoy surprises again." "Good for you. And you have no memory of this problem, or of having this conversation before when you were me?" Britt the Much Elder leaned back and closed her eyes.
"No, I have no memory of this conversation."
"Doesn't that strike you as odd?"
Britt the Much Elder nodded.
"Oh, yeah, totally. But I'm sure there's an explanation. Maybe Britt the Much Elder made me so mad that I went home and got blackout drunk.
I really disliked me when I was you."
"Yeah.
And you had..."
"I have my reasons."
"You do.
And with the advantage of age, I see now that those reasons are silly. You're holding a grudge against me because of how I treated you when I was Britt the Elder and you were Britt the Younger, but that's how Britt the Elder treated me when I was Britt the Younger, and it's the exact way you're treating Britt the Younger now."
Britt the Elder leaned forward and spoke through gritted teeth.
"I'm not mad because of how you treated me. I could take it. I'm mad at you because it means I have to treat Britt the Younger the same way, and I hate myself for it."
"No more than I did. What's done is done. Multiple times in our case. You'll get over it. In time." "I did. In fact, to make that easier for you, speaking as Britt the Younger who I was, I forgive you."
Britt the Elder blinked several times as she attempted to process what she'd just heard.
That's very nice, I think.
Thank you.
Britt the Much Elder smiled.
Of course. In fact, while I'm at it, I was also you, and on behalf of you, in advance, I forgive myself, who you will one day be.
Was that supposed to make me feel better?
Yes, and it will. By the time you're me, you'll be perfectly at peace with all of this crap.
Fantastic. In the meantime, we have a real problem, and you don't seem to be taking it seriously.
Britt the Much Elder held up her palms, signaling that Britt the Elder should calm down.
Yeah, I know, I agree. It's weird.
Weird? You say it's weird?
We're talking about a logical paradox that casts doubt on every assumption we've ever made about our life, and threatens to corrupt and possibly even crash the computer program that generates our existence. I think it's fair to say that goes beyond just being weird.
Okay, it's really weird. I can see that this whole thing has you on edge.
Yes,
Britt the Elder almost shouted.
I'd say it's fair to describe me as on edge. I haven't shown you the best part yet.
She kicked off her ballet flats. For the first time, Britt the Much Elder seemed genuinely alarmed.
What are you doing?
Britt the Elder said,
showing you these,
and lifted her feet up so that Britt the Much Elder could see them. At first, they looked just like Britt's bare feet, which she'd seen many times before, since they were her own.
Then they looked different.
Britt the Elder's feet changed from perfectly normal-looking human feet to two crude collections of polygons, approximating the basic shape of human feet without any of the details. Her feet remained that way for about a second and a half, then switched back to normal, then cycled to and from the polygon version several times in the space of a second before changing back to normal feet. Britt the Much Elder stared.
That's not right.
No, it is not.
And you don't remember any of this?
Nope, not at all.
And your feet?
No, my feet are fine, and I agree that it's a serious issue.
And getting more serious, it's spreading. It started with just my toes, now it's the whole feet, and it starts affecting whatever shoes I wear. I've gone through two pairs of flats since I noticed the problem.
I'll help you in any way that I can.
Well, good, but I don't understand how you can be so calm about this.
I'm calm because I'm you in the future and I still exist. It seems like if this was going to cause some serious problem, it would have by now.
Don't you see? This is an error in the program that is our universe. The fact that you don't get that, but I do, is proof that your memories are no longer tied to my actions or thoughts, which means that everything is on a fundamental level completely messed up. The fact that you still exist isn't proof that things are fine, it's a symptom of the problem. The universe could crash at any second. It could even be that me coming to you will cause the final logic error, but I didn't know what else to do. And if I'm wrong, then what about the philosophical ramifications of that? What if all these years we've been tormenting each other because we thought we had no choice, but in fact we had a choice all along?
Britt the Much Elder leaned further back in her chair.
I don't know if it's, what you call it, the perspective that comes with age, or if it's that I've seen so much weird stuff at this point that I just don't notice it anymore. Or maybe those are actually the same thing. The point is, I stopped worrying about all of those philosophical issues years ago. When it comes to free will, these days I just figure if I'm meant to have it, I'll have it.
That attitude must drive Philip nuts.
How would I know?
Good point.
6. Britt the Younger was curled up reading in her favorite chair when Philip walked out of the bedroom in his full wizard regalia and walked toward the front door.
Where are you going? Britt asked without lifting her eyes from the page.
Philip stopped dead in his tracks, turned to face her and said,
Just out for a walk. What are you reading?
Britt turned the book around to look at the cover, a picture of two shirtless men with long hair, both obscured by motion blur. One appeared to be crouched low and somehow spinning at high speed, while the other was suspended mid-jump, executing a high kick.
It's a book I borrowed from Louisa. It's about this martial art they developed in Brazil called capoeira. It's a sort of mix of fighting and dancing.
Kind of like slam dancing?
Well, it's incredibly graceful and athletic, and an efficient fighting style, so no, it is in no way like slam dancing. Where are you going?
What?
On your walk, where are you going?
Oh, nowhere, just, you know, out.
Cool. Enjoy your walk to nowhere.
Yes, very good. Quite, I will.
After several seconds of Britt saying nothing further, Philip again stepped toward the door. He had nearly reached it when Nick called out from the kitchen.
Philip, did I hear you say you're stepping out for a moment?
Yes.
Remember yesterday how you said to tell you if there was anything you could do to make my job easier?
Yes, of course.
Well, if you're going out anyway, could you pick up a chicken for tonight's dinner?
Of course, Philip said. A chicken? How would you like it?
Nick furrowed his brow and stared at Philip.
Just the breast or the whole thing? Boned? Unboned? With or without skin?
Nick asked.
What? What are you talking about?
Live. Britt said, quietly enough that Philip would barely hear, but Nick wouldn't.
In this time period, the only way to buy a chicken is live.
Philip nodded a quick thanks to Britt.
Never mind, Nick. I was just being silly. One live chicken coming up.
Thanks, Philip. Feel free to wring its neck yourself if you want.
Philip cringed and looked at Britt, who was also cringing, but she was smiling at him as she did it. One of the first lessons any modern person learns when they go to live in the distant past is that everyone, including the domestic servants, are much more hardcore than you will ever be. Philip stepped out the door to a sunny Atlantis morning. Martin materialized on the landing to Britt the Younger's home and watched as Philip stepped out the door onto the Atlantean street, muttering,
"One live chicken."
Philip closed the door behind him, turned to walk away, and nearly walked straight into Martin. Martin smiled and said, "Hello." Philip let out a tiny, high-pitched shriek and jumped a few inches into the air.
"Oh, man, I'm sorry,"
Martin said, laughing.
"Yes, you sound it. What do you want, Martin?"
"Just to talk."
"Well, then, why not just call me?"
"I wanted to talk to you in person. Alone? I kind of hoped it would seem like I just ran into you, all casual-like."
"Well, those hopes have been dashed."
Philip looked at the closed door into Britt the Younger's apartment, then back at Martin.
"Still, why just lurk out here? Seems like a waste of time, and I might well have had Britt with me."
Martin smiled.
"Oh, I haven't been waiting. I set up an algorithm to watch all of the doors of your and Britt's places and tell me the next time you came out alone so I could teleport over."
"Oh,"
Philip said.
"That's certainly alarming."
"Don't worry. There's no reason to be alarmed, as long as I only use the algorithm for good."
"Very reassuring."
Philip started walking and Martin followed.
"So where are you headed?"
Martin asked.
"Nowhere. Just out for a walk."
"Then you won't mind if I come along?"
"I suppose it won't hurt anything if you tag along for a bit."
Immediately upon setting out, Martin saw that there was much more clutter and traffic on the street than usual. The going was slow, as all traffic was squeezed through a narrow channel carved through all of the detritus on either side of the path. The way in front of them was flanked by hastily made scaffolds holding workmen, various tools, and an oblong tin basin. Various wooden planks and other building materials cluttered the ground. In the distance, near a trough where people let their animals drink, a metal dome-like structure hung high in the air, perched at the top of a metal rail that stuck straight up like a flagpole. The whole assembly looked to Martin like the world's least effective and most dangerous umbrella. Ahead and to the right, a set of stairs was carved into the wall of a building leading up to the roof level, where the next path up allowed still more people to walk around the circumference of the Great Bowl of Atlantis. Martin wondered if that path was as crowded as this one today. He considered suggesting that they take it to get out of the crowd, but then he saw a large bucket sitting unattended at the top of the stairs. Further along the edge he could make out a strange wooden contraption made up of two big wooden gears and a crank. He took it as a sign that progress would be no less difficult up there. Martin shielded his eyes, squinting up at the scaffolding.
"What is going on here?"
"Looks like some sort of construction,"
Philip said.
"Don't the sorceresses do all the building in Atlantis?"
Brit the Elder built it to begin with, but I assume the citizens take on the occasional project themselves.
Martin furrowed his brow. Why wouldn't they just ask a sorceress to do it?
I don't know. Is this really what you wanted to discuss, Martin?
No, sorry. It's this Gwen thing.
Oh, of course it is.
I think I want to marry her.
So you say.
The idea that she doesn't feel the same way, it's just awful.
I would imagine.
Philip, you know, you're not really saying anything useful here. Martin glanced up at the edge of the path above theirs. They drawn closer to the weird mechanical apparatus. Martin saw that it consisted of two large gears, a long shaft, a wooden paddle, and a wooden dowel hanging from a crossbar, with a large boot hanging at its end. The boot didn't alarm Martin, even though it appeared to be a modern combat boot. The city was controlled by time travelers. It wasn't unusual to see anachronistic things pop up where they didn't belong. But something about the entire construction bothered Martin, as if he'd seen it before somewhere. Philip did not slow his pace.
You haven't asked me any questions, Martin, and you know much more about the situation than I do, unless there's some specific piece of Gwen-related information I know that you don't. I'm not sure I'm going to be much help. Perhaps if you go think of some specific way I can be of assistance, then come back.
Where are you going?
What?
Where are you going, Philip? You seem to be in a rush to get somewhere. Philip said,
What? No, I'm just out for a walk.
You're keeping up a heck of a steady pace.
The whole point of going for a walk is to walk. Otherwise, it wouldn't be walking.
Martin's eyes narrowed. Uh-huh. And why pick such a congested area for your walk? Philip looked lost for a moment, then said,
Nobody likes to eat in an empty restaurant.
On the path above, the complex wooden machine creaked into motion. Martin didn't see anyone turning the crank, but the two gears rotated, causing the shaft to move, pushing the paddle into the boot, which swung forward and hit the bucket sitting at the top of the stairs. The bucket fell over, and a large sphere, similar to a bowling ball but carved of stone, rolled out and started slowly working its way down the stairs. Who just leaves a stone ball sitting in a bucket? Martin asked. Philip made only a small grunt to acknowledge Martin's question, which he clearly hadn't really heard, as he continued to work his way through the crowd. Martin pointed to the stone ball, still torturously working its way one tread at a time down the stairs, emitting a low rumble as it rolled, and a percussive bang each time it fell. And how was a boot heavy enough to knock over a bucket that was holding that thing in the first place? The ball reached the bottom of the stairs and rolled along a barely noticeable furrow in the ground. The people near enough to the ball for it to be a tripping hazard all saw and carefully avoided it, but the bulk of the crowd, including Philip, remained oblivious. The ball wended its way along beside the path and finally crashed into the base of one of the scaffolds. The shock worked its way up the supports, magnifying as it went until the platform, roughly two stories up, rocked violently. Martin watched as the motion dislodged a second stone ball, which rolled along the length of the platform. Martin slowed to a stop, his eyes glued to the top of the scaffold. Okay, he muttered. What is this? The second ball fell off the end of the planks, landing in the oblong basin on the platform below, and rolled along its length. When it reached the far end, the floor gave out, leaving a perfectly round hole where the sphere broke through. The stone ball landed on a pile of loose building materials, hitting the raised end of a thick plank of wood. The ball drove the planks high end down like a teeter-totter, lifting the far end, which Martin had not seen was under the heels of a statue waiting to be installed. The statue flew into the air and landed in the water trough, creating a huge splash and nudging the metal pole that held the metal lattice dome aloft. People scattered as the webbed hemisphere slid down the pole, but not all of the people. Philip, single-mindedly working his way through the crowd, had not noticed anything odd, and only snapped out of his stupor as the area around him suddenly emptied. He looked up, just as the iron dome crashed down over him.
Well, this is just typical, isn't it?
Philip said.
Yeah, you never get trapped in a falling metal cage unless you're in a hurry.
I'm not in a hurry, Martin. I'm just out for a stroll.
Philip looked at the metal framework surrounding him.
That said, I think, since I'm going to have to teleport out of here anyway, I'll just go ahead and go all the way to my walk's, natural endpoint, and walk back.
Sounds good, Martin said. Let's go.
Yeah. Martin, here's the thing, I'd kind of like to continue alone.
Of course you would. I understand completely.
Do you?
Philip looked stricken for an instant, but regained his composure.
Oh, good. Well, see you around, Martin.
See ya, Philip said.
Transporto al.
Then looked at Martin and muttered the last part under his breath. Philip disappeared. Martin grasped the steel cage and shook it, feeling its strength. He wondered what it was supposed to do and why it had been perched at the top of a pole to begin with. He looked at the statue sticking out of the tub of water, the teeter-totter plank, both stone balls, and the boot and bucket at the top of the stairs. It all seemed to be trying to stir a memory in him, but like an urge to sneeze that just fades away, it left Martin unsatisfied, with a squinty expression on his face. He stood there, concentrating for several seconds, before it finally came to him,
Mousetrap. It's the crazy machine you put together in the board game Mousetrap!
That one realization triggered a chain reaction of further deductions in Martin's mind. It was too big a coincidence that the mechanism from Mousetrap would get recreated in its entirety by accident. That meant someone had to deliberately recreate it. That meant that the person who recreated it had to have been from a time when Mousetrap existed, i.e., the future. That meant that it was created by a time traveler, someone who had found the file. This was too complicated to be Gary's work, too high concept and far too public and risky to be any of their other friends. The cage was only large enough for one person and was set up in an area that Philip frequented. It was sort of a fluke that Martin was there, which suggested that the whole ornate ruse had been put together specifically for Philip, much like the package the night before. The conclusion hit Martin like a rolled-up towel, snapping him in the brain.
It's the Jawa!
Martin spun around, searching the area, until he saw the familiar burlap hood peeking over the edge of a roof. The cloaked figure flinched and darted out of sight the instant it became clear that Martin saw him. The strange thing about teleportation is that it's the fastest, most convenient means of transportation imaginable once you know where you're going. Selecting and then somehow designating a landing spot close to where you want to be that isn't inside a wall or suspended several feet above the ground, or both, can be a fiddly, time-consuming task, unless you've developed a workaround. Thanks to his dual childhood loves of X-Men comics and the game Toss Across, Martin had. He reached into his pocket, grasped the small beanbag, and threw it hard and fast at the spot where the cloaked figure had been. It landed with an audible thump. Martin said,
BAMF,
and teleported, materializing on the upper level where the beanbag had landed. He scooped the beanbag up and hurled it as hard as he could into the fleeing wizard's back. As the beanbag bounced off the running figure's cloak, Martin said, BAMF, again, and materialized directly behind him. Martin grasped the man's hood, which slid off his head and quickly pulled tight around his neck, becoming a leash of sorts. Martin's staff fell, clattering to the ground as he pulled back on the hood with both hands. With his hood pulled down, the Jawa's bald, misshapen head and pointed ears were exposed. He let out a string of strangled curses in a low, guttural voice as he stopped running and turned around, causing the hood and neck of his cloak to twist around to the front of his throat. His emerald green eyes radiated fury, distracting from his long, pointed nose, his thin, cruel lips, and his mouthful of jagged teeth. Martin asked,
"What are you, some kind of goblin?"
The stranger slapped at Martin's hands.
Maybe. So what, you prejudice or something? Let go! Let go, damn you!
He spat in a deep, unnatural growl as he unleashed a barrage of stinging slaps. Martin tugged harder at the hood and shouted,
No!
The two of them stood there at the center of a growing crowd of Atlanteans, Martin pulling on the hood while the goblin slapped and cursed to no avail. Finally, the goblin grasped his own hood and twisted it, causing Martin's hands to rotate, loosening his grip enough to allow the goblin to break free. Martin took a hasty step backward to keep from falling down, but tripped over his own staff and landed directly on his tailbone. He sprang to his feet and jumped up and down, hunched over with both hands clasped to the spot where lower back becomes upper butt.
The goblin backed up several steps, watching Martin dance and moan in pain, before finally thrusting his finger at him and shouting,
"Yeah! Serves you right!"
Martin stopped jumping and moaning, but remained hunched over and left his hands where they were. He looked up at the goblin and shouted,
"Who are you and why are you trying to hurt Philip?"
"What? I'm not trying to hurt Philip."
"Sure. Who are you?"
"Well, nobody you should worry about. Just forget you ever saw me."
"What should I call you?"
"Nothing. You shouldn't call me. Don't talk to me or about me or near me. Forget that I exist."
He waved his arms around in great swirling arcs. Ravens flew in from behind every building and around every corner. From any place in Martin's field of vision, large enough to conceal even one raven, many appeared, until the air was so full of flying blackbirds that the bright cloudless day seemed gray and overcast.
"Listen to me, and listen well, Martin Banks. Do not interfere with me. Forget you ever saw me. Or else the consequences will be dire."
Martin asked, "Dire for who?" The goblin said,
"I think you mean dire for whom? And the answer is you, obviously. Dire for you."
Martin said, "I don't think it's that obvious at all." He dove for his staff, slid on his belly as he grasped it and rolled over. He pointed the staff's head at the other wizard and shouted,
"Malsequeta pantalolo!"
The goblin instinctively shielded his head and ghoulish face with his arms. He stood frozen for several seconds, waiting for the spell to manifest itself. Then a confused expression came over his face. He scowled, rotated his pelvis a few times, and said,
"Okay, what the hell?"
Martin stood up, looking pleased with himself.
"I realized a long time ago that it's next to impossible to really hurt a magic user. We're pretty much invulnerable. We can be embarrassed, though. So I started working on the spell I just hit you with. The pants wetter."
The goblin rolled his eyes and whined.
"Oh, man, that's just...
I know, right? That's kind of the point. You'll be happy to hear it's just water.
Of course, it's still a work in progress. The final version will just cause a stain about 5 inches around. This one completely saturates the pants. It's kind of overkill."
"It's pointless. I'm wearing a robe, you dolt. Nobody can see that my pants are wet."
"But you know it,"
Martin said. The goblin stepped forward, then convulsed into a full-body cringe.
"Oh, man, I hate the feeling of wet pants."
"So you find the discomfort to be a deterrent as well,"
Martin said.
"Noted. Thanks for the feedback."
"Feedback? You want feedback? Here, let me introduce you to my focus group."
The goblin swept his arms around and brought them together, clapping with stiff arms so that his hands pointed directly at Martin. The thousands of ravens that had been swirling around over their heads changed direction as one, converging on Martin. Martin's brain was certain that the birds were not real. The way they all looked identical, moved in exactly the same repeating pattern, and made the same noise was a dead giveaway that they were part of a man-made macro and couldn't really hurt him. His feet didn't want to hear it. He had turned and run 2 steps before he realized what he was doing. Of course, before he completed his 3rd step, the birds were on him. Martin spun and shouted and swung his arms wildly, but nothing he did dislodged the flapping, cawing mass of talons, beaks, and feathers. He staggered several steps, blind, caught his balance, and stopped. He continued swinging his arms, but more slowly, then only a little, feeling to see if it made any difference, which it did not. Martin stood motionless for a moment, collected his thoughts, as well as one could when covered with a chaotic mass of angry, screeching birds, then turned back toward the goblin, or at least in the direction he believed the goblin had been standing, since he only caught the smallest glimpse of light through the mass of birds. Martin said,
"They don't hurt."
The goblin shouted,
"What? I can't hear you."
"It doesn't hurt,"
Martin repeated as loud as he could.
"I'm impervious to cuts and scrapes, so this isn't doing anything."
"Yes, it is. It's making you look ridiculous."
"How long are they going to keep doing this?"
"Until I leave, so they'll be quitting in a second."
Martin reached out blindly with his crow-covered hands.
No, wait, hold on!
He felt the bird start to let go, and within a few seconds he was completely unencumbered. The birds flocked around the goblin and flew in an ever-tightening spiral, their numbers diminishing until there were only a few birds, then only one, then none, and no goblin either. Martin looked at the empty space where the goblin had stood. He spun around and saw the citizens slowly emerging from their various hiding spots and bits of shelter. He noted that all of the apparatus from the full-sized recreation of the game Mousetrap had also disappeared. All of the evidence was gone.
Not all of the evidence, he thought, looking down at his robe.
Martin was impervious to damage, but his robe was not. The crows had shredded the outer layer of fabric. The entire surface was in tatters, and every time he moved, sequins dropped to the ground.
Normally, I just ask Gwen to repair it, or make me a new one. Right now, I think I'd rather go another round with the birds.
7. Philip materialized at the bottom of the city, on the terrace in front of Britt the Elder's home. The great bowl of Atlantis rose on all sides, looming over him and framing the ragged-edged disk of blue sky above. Philip looked toward the collection of smooth, opaque glass boxes that made up Britt the Elder's home. A series of sliding glass doors led to the interior, but it was far too dark inside for Philip to make out any details. Just outside the sliding doors, two Atlantean sentries guarded the entrance. Both stood a full head taller than Philip, and wore the Atlantean guard's official uniform, shirts of orange netting made with matching surprisingly short orange kilts. Philip waved at the guards and contorted his mouth into the insincere grin he employed to camouflage the displeasure he felt when talking to petty authority figures.
"Hello? I'd like to speak to Britt the Elder."
The more senior guard contorted his mouth into the insincere grin he employed to camouflage the pleasure he felt when denying someone something they wanted.
"That's not possible, sir."
"I suspect she'd want to see me if she knew I was here."
"I know for a fact we were told not to let anyone disturb her."
The floor-to-ceiling glass doors slid open without warning, emitting a slight hissing sound that drew the attention of Philip and the guards. Britt the Elder's voice, amplified many times but still reproduced with perfect ringing clarity, said,
"Let him in."
The guard nodded to Philip, which was as close as Philip would ever get to an apology. Philip nodded back, which was as close as he would ever come to saying, "I told you so." The guard made a point of not watching as Philip walked across the patio and entered the house. The place had a genuine sense of disorder about it, but at first Philip couldn't put his finger on why. The furniture looked exactly as it had when he'd last visited. The carpet was spotless, marred only by a faint wear pattern that a quick vacuuming would erase. A couple of the end tables held empty glasses, and the dining table was strewn with books, but all in all the place looked much like his own did after he'd tidied up. Yet this was Britt the Elder's home, and Philip found even the slightest detail being visibly out of place deeply unsettling. Britt the Elder's voice called out from the deeper recesses of the house.
"I'm back here. In the office. Last door on the left."
Philip found Britt the Elder sitting behind her yellowed Macintosh. The only light in the room was the glow from the tiny CRT screen, shining up on her face from below and reflecting in her glasses, completely hiding her eyes. Philip chuckled softly.
"Of course. You have the same kind of computer as Britt the Younger."
Britt the Elder sat back in her chair and looked up at Philip. Even the slightest movement of her head made the shadows shift wildly across her face.
"It's not the same kind of computer, Philip. It's the same computer. I've had this computer since I was in college, as well as when I was Britt the Younger."
"Oh,"
Philip said.
"Of course."
"But then you don't really believe that, do you, Philip? You think I'm some sort of a copy, or a projection of one possible future Brit, but not the literal continuation of the Brit you love, isn't that right?"
"I don't pretend to understand the mechanism behind it, but I do believe that we all, Brit included, have free will. She can make her own decisions. and as such she's not doomed to become anything she doesn't want to be.
Me, in this case.
I'm afraid so. Although I will say that I don't quite understand why she finds the idea of being like you so hateful.
You're sweet. The unflattering lighting made Brit the Elder's smile look like an eerie grimace. Have a seat. Sorry the place is such a mess. Philip found a chair against the wall and pulled it forward to sit opposite Brit the Elder, just to the side so that the ancient computer didn't block his view of her face.
I don't see any mess, Philip said, settling into the chair.
Brit the Elder looked around the room as if she was just seeing it now for the first time.
What?
Oh, I see what you mean. It is pretty tidy in here. One of the benefits of the paperless office, I guess. I assure you my desktop is a mess. So, Philip, I'm glad you came by. I have a question I've been meaning to ask you.
Anything?
Good. When you went to Kluge and asked him and his gang to be sparring partners for your training fights, what did he say?
He said yes.
Brit the Elder nodded. Yeah, so I've heard. What did he say exactly? Was he ambiguous at all? Was there any room for misinterpretation?
At first he was dubious, but when I explained that we wizards would be pulling our punches, but that he and his lads were encouraged to do their best to kill us, he offered to start right then and there.
Yeah, that's pretty unambiguous.
Look, I came here because I heard you've been going around asking weird questions, and people said you seemed out of sorts, like you weren't really yourself. Now I'm here, and I see exactly what they meant. What's going on?
I don't know what's going on. That's the problem. Philip, I remember you asking Kluge and the bastards to be your sparring partners, but the way I remember it, he told you to get stuffed. And it took another year of wooing him to get him to come around.
So you misremembered something. It happens to everyone.
Not to me. And I checked, never mind how. I didn't misremember. When I was Brit the Younger, Kluge turned us down. Now he's on board. Philip thought for a long moment.
Oh, I see. This is a big deal.
Yes, it is.
The implications?
I agree.
This means that I'm right.
I wouldn't say that.
I've been right all along.
I certainly wouldn't say that.
This is great.
No, Philip, it's a disaster.
Really? Is it such a problem for me to be right?
You're not right, Philip.
But surely this proves that I am.
No, you being right is just one possibility that this might suggest. For it to prove you right, it would have to outweigh my entire lifetime of experiences, all of which bolster the position that you're wrong. That's over 100 years, during which every single event I've witnessed, every prediction I've made, every memory I've had has unfolded exactly as I recalled it. In order for you to be right, all of those experiences would have to have been some sort of coincidence.
So how do you explain it?
Something's gone wrong. An error got introduced into the system somehow. Maybe it was Kluge being agreeable, I don't know, it's hard to say. The point is, there's a logical paradox. From the point where I remember you making your offer, onward, I've lived my life as if he said no. But now, from the moment you made your offer on, the rest of the world, including Brit the Younger, has gone on as if he said yes. So far, I'm the only one who has felt any of the consequences. But it's gonna be like ripples in a pond. They'll only get larger and reach further.
What do you think will happen if you're right?
Eventually, there'll be a logical paradox that the system can't reconcile, followed by a crash.
A crash? What do you think this crash would look like?
It wouldn't look like anything. We wouldn't even know it had happened.
Oh, good.
No, not good. Us, the world, the entire universe, and every living thing in it could freeze and then wink out of existence with absolutely no warning or way to escape.
But when the program boots back up...
There's no guarantee that it would. If it did, there's no reason to believe that the program would generate us again. Even if it did generate another Philip McCall or Brittany Ryan, they wouldn't be us. They'd be new versions. We would be gone.
And you think this is likely?
Philip asked. No, not likely, Brit the Elder said.
Good.
Inevitable. I'd say that if we don't do something, it's inevitable. And every second that passes, it gets closer.
Philip started to speak, then stopped, and simply sat there with his head hung low and his shoulders slumped.
I know, Britt the Elder said. It's terrible.
I'll say. I've always maintained that you and Britt the Younger are separate, distinct people, and everyone's always laughed at me for it. Now the evidence finally seems to prove me right, and you see it as proof that the universe is fundamentally broken.
I'm sorry, Philip, but I'll side with logic, reason, and a lifetime of experience over your opinion, and a single anomaly every time. Besides, I have evidence that something's gone wrong with the program.
She pointed downward, suggesting that Philip look under her desk.
Philip looked confused, then smiled uncomfortably, shrugged, and leaned to the side, bending his neck and grasping the corner of the desk for support as he looked beneath it. It was difficult to see in the dim light, but he made out the hem of Britt the Elder's floral dress, a bit of her exposed shins, and a pair of fur-lined, taupe-suede pull-on boots that reached clear up to the middle of her calves. Philip shrugged.
The boots are odious, obviously, but I don't know that you can blame the program for that.
One of the sorceresses from the early 2000s gave them to me as a gift. I have to admit they're comfortable, but I put them on because I didn't care if they got damaged.
Damaged by what?
Watch.
At first, Philip saw nothing unusual, because nothing was unusual. For 3 seconds, Britt the Elder's feet looked perfectly normal. Then, they didn't. The change happened so quickly, Philip's brain took a moment to register that anything had happened. He grabbed his staff and muttered a quick spell, making the staff act as a flashlight. With the area under the desk fully illuminated, he saw her boots shift from looking like real boots to resembling crude digital representations of boots. Britt the Elder kicked off the boots, exposing her bare feet to drive her point home. As Philip watched, her feet shifted from their normal form to the low polygon version and back several times, seemingly at random. At that moment, a high-pitched keening noise rang in Philip's ears. He winced and looked down at his palm where he saw the sparkling bust of Santo and heard the eerie organ sting that signified Martin trying to call him. He kept his eyes on Britt the Elder's glitching feet as he took the call.
Martin, there's something I need to tell you.
Britt the Elder cleared her throat and shook her head emphatically.
There's something I need to tell you, which is that I can't talk now.
You answered the call to tell me you can't talk?
Yes, I didn't want to be rude.
Whatever. Fine. Don't talk, just listen. Philip, someone attacked you.
You mean someone's going to attack me?
No, someone already has. That steel cage that fell on you, it wasn't an accident.
But that didn't hurt me at all.
It wasn't meant to hurt you. It was part of a big elaborate plan to get your attention.
So you're saying that someone is just trying to catch my eye, and they failed so far?
Yes.
That's the least threatening thing I've ever heard.
Philip, you have to take this seriously. I don't think he's going to give up. He's tried twice already.
Twice?
That package on your doorstep those kids stole was part of it, too.
Oh, God, are you on that again? So it's the Jawa who's after me?
He's not a Jawa. I never said he was a Jawa. That was you.
I suppose that's true.
He's a goblin.
Martin, I'm sorry, but I have more important problems than your flights of fancy.
Like what? You told me you weren't going anywhere and weren't doing anything.
Yeah, that's right, and it's still more important than your paranoid delusions.
Philip hung up, then stared at Britt the Elder's feet. Britt the Elder looked askance at Philip.
What? Are they doing something new?
Philip pointed to the area below the desk. Britt the Elder pushed her chair back and looked at the floor beneath her feet. Every time her feet shifted from one state to the other, the carpet beneath her feet changed as well. A circle a couple of feet across switched from carpet to a perfectly flat, smooth surface the same color as the carpet. Britt the Elder said,
"Huh, that's new.
Proves that the glitch is spreading to the world beyond me. I suppose it's good to know for sure." Philip continued staring at the empty space where her foot had just been.
Why on earth did you show me this?
Because I want your help.
I don't know how I can possibly help you.
Neither do I, but together I'm sure we'll think of something.
But you think I'm wrong about everything?
Not everything, Philip, just one thing. The fundamental mechanism underlying the entire universe. Aside from that, your instincts are usually pretty good. You're a smart man and a good man, and there's nobody I trust more. Will you please help me?
Of course. You don't even have to ask. Of course I'll help you.
Good. Thank you.
I think the first thing I should do is tell Britt, Bring her in on this.
No, I'm afraid the first thing you need to do is promise me that you will not tell Britt the Younger anything about any of this until I say it's okay.
And when will that be?
Probably never.
You can't expect me to keep this a secret from her?
That's exactly what I expect.
But she'd want to know.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, sure, we can speculate that she'd probably want to know, but I can tell you for a fact that I don't want you to tell her.
But you claim to be her. You want me to keep this a secret from you?
Yes, that's exactly how you should look at this, Philip. I am Britt, the older, wiser Britt, and I'm telling you not to tell the younger, more foolish me what's going on. Besides, you can't anyway, because I don't remember you telling me when I was her, so you didn't then, and you can't now.
But that doesn't matter anymore. Your past and our present have diverged. All bets are off now.
No, the bets are still on, and the stakes are much higher. Think, Philip, the timeline has split, but both paths are still right here next to each other, and she and I are on the two different paths. Any interaction between the two of us, even if it's just her finding out what's going on with me, could be the thing that crashes reality.
Then why tell me at all?
Because I trust you.
So does she. I'm the person most likely to tell her.
And the person most likely to keep my secret. For Britt the Younger's own good, and the continued survival of our entire reality. It won't be easy, I know. Especially since you'll have to find a way to keep sneaking away from her to come and help me get to the bottom of this and repair the damage.
You're asking a lot.
I'm not, really.
You don't think sneaking around behind the back of the woman I love is a big deal?
I know it is. What I meant is that I'm not asking. I'm not asking you to do something. I'm informing you that you're going to. Logically, you were committed the moment I decided to tell you what was going on.
You don't remember any of this. How do you know I won't tell her and keep it a secret from you?
You're far too smart to betray my trust and risk our continued existence. Just to tell Britt the Younger something that's going to make her angry at you anyway. I certainly don't see any upside in that.
This is a hell of a situation you've put me in.
Yes, I know. But remember, I'm her. So if it makes you feel better, in a very real sense, she puts you in this situation.
8.
The subject has started the car,
Agent Miller said, leaning forward in his seat and peering through the semi-fogged windshield. He gripped the steering wheel in one hand and the keys in the ignition with the other. Agent Murphy continued reading his laptop.
Yeah? Great. Keep me posted.
He's pulling out of the parking space.
Fantastic. It's certainly worth getting all excited over. He's definitely not just messing with us this time.
What's happened to your attitude, Murph? Why am I the positive one all of a sudden?
You're not being positive. You smell blood. You're desperate to take Jimmy down, and that's made it easier for him to jerk you around, which only makes you want to take him down even more. It's a vicious cycle, and I'm tired of it.
Well, the cycle's been broken, Miller said. He's pulling out of the parking lot.
Miller started the car, which immediately stalled. Murphy sighed, opening his door.
I'll get the banana,
Miller said.
Hurry, I don't want to lose him.
Behind the car, people shrieked and laughed. One woman pounded on Miller's side window. The voice of some unseen pedestrian from the rear of the car rang out,
Ha! You fell for the banana in the tailpipe!
Shut up!
Miller shouted, spittle flying from his mouth and hitting the still rolled up window.
You shut the hell up!
Murphy walked to the back of the car, not stopping to answer any of the pedestrians' questions about bananas, tailpipes, Beverly Hills Cop, or Mythbusters. Across the street, Jimmy's Lexus took a left turn out of the parking lot. As Murphy got back in the car, Miller started the engine, shifted into first, and mashed the accelerator.
Hold on, Murphy said. Hold on, I haven't even closed my door yet.
No time, Miller said. He's on the move, and I ain't losing him.
As they joined the flow of traffic, Miller leaned far to one side, then the other, muttering,
Where is he? Where is he? There he is. Three cars up. He's signaling a left.
Calm down, Murphy said. You're fogging up the windows.
Then turn on the defogger. We're gonna get him, Murph. He's gonna slip up and we're gonna get him.
Murphy fumbled with the climate controls until the vents made a whooshing noise, so loud he had to raise his voice to be heard.
No, we aren't, Miller. Our orders are to observe.
Miller reached up with his left hand and loosened his collar.
Well, we're gonna observe him slipping up. Then we're gonna get him.
We aren't gonna observe anything if this window doesn't clear up.
Turn the blower up!
It's up! The blower is up! It doesn't blow any harder than that!
Both men cranked their windows down. Miller peered through the hazy windshield.
I think he's getting in the turn lane.
Signaling a turn, then turning? What could that fiend be up to?
If you're gonna be a smartass, Murph, at least make yourself useful. Wipe some of this crap off the window so I can see, would you?
Murphy leaned over, stretched his arm out, and used his bare hand to wipe a small hole in the fog. Cold, condensed water rolled off his hand and fell in fat drops on the dashboard.
The open windows aren't helping.
Yeah, I can see that.
Miller pulled the car into the left turn lane, two cars behind Jimmy's Lexus.
It's not defogging, Miller. Not at all. It shouldn't be foggy at all. And it's refusing to defog. I mean, look, the spot I rubbed clear is already fogging up again.
Yes, so wipe it again. He's turning. He's turning.
Murphy wiped a hand-sized clear spot in front of himself and leaned forward to look through it.
Yeah, he's turning all right, Miller. He's taking a U-turn.
He's trying to lose us.
The car sputtered and died. Murphy said,
We should be so lucky.
He opened his door and hot-footed it to the rear of the car to remove the banana they both knew was in the exhaust pipe. When he re-entered the car, Miller was honking the horn at the two cars in front of them. Finally, both cars executed their left turns. Murphy adjusted the rearview mirror and said,
Yeah, there was a banana in the tailpipe. We hadn't even shut the car off. We were just stopped waiting to turn. It doesn't even make sense.
Miller steered their rented sedan through a tight U-turn that made the tires and the power steering system squeal.
Miller,
Murphy continued.
He's messing with us again.
Miller had his head out the window in an attempt to see. He glanced at Murphy and said,
What?
But he was clearly focusing more on the chase than anything his partner had to say.
He's messing with us. I'm pretty sure he's making the window fog up somehow, and he's leading us around so that the fogging will be a problem. Miller, are you listening to me?
He's turning again, right this time.
You're not listening to me.
Murphy leaned over and wiped a large clear patch in front of his partner again. Miller pulled his head back into the car.
Thanks, partner.
You're welcome. So, he's turning right?
Yeah.
Tell me, are we back near the building he lives in?
He's about to pass it.
He's slowing down, isn't he?
Maybe it's traffic.
Murphy didn't bother to wipe a spot to look through. He just sat back, watched the scenery roll past his open side window, and listened to his partner shout obscenities as Jimmy pulled back into the parking lot of the luxurious Rothschild building, which he just left. When Miller had exhausted himself, Murphy said,
Go up to the next light and pull another U-turn. If nobody beats us to it, maybe we can get our old parking spot back.
9. Martin materialized without any warning or entrance music. He hovered in midair, his feet pulled up beneath him to leave as much clearance above the floor as possible. He waved his staff threateningly with his left hand, ready to cast any one of a number of defensive spells he had at the ready. He held his right hand over his eyes like a child at a scary movie they'd mistakenly thought they were old enough to handle, using his semi-spread fingers to filter out anything he didn't really want to see. Instead of an attacker of any kind, Martin saw only the interior of Gary's home, Skull Gullet Cave. He saw no sign of Gary nor anybody else, but Martin knew Gary well enough not to take his absence for granted. He hovered, spinning slowly, guarding for an attack that never came. Finally, he removed his hand from his eyes, stretched his legs out, and landed.
Hey, Gary!
Martin shouted.
You home?
Back here in the bedroom.
Gary's distant voice replied.
Come on back.
Martin walked past the overbuilt couch and recliners, past the rudimentary kitchen, and down the hallway that led to the bathroom and bedroom. He found the bedroom door slightly ajar, and heard hushed voices.
"Is this satisfactory, Master?"
"Yes, but next time, remember to put your gloves on first."
Martin put his hand, fingers slightly spread, back over his eyes, and pushed the door open. Gary's bedroom was much as Martin remembered it, a very large, modern bed covered with disheveled sheets and a black bedspread, sat in a room devoid of any decorative wall hangings. At the foot of the bed, Gary stood, wearing only a pair of plain briefs. Martin didn't know if he was surprised or relieved to see that they weren't brightly colored and festooned with the logo of some superhero. A black T-shirt hung limply from Gary's hand. Hubert stood nearby, wearing the jacket and bow tie of a formal tuxedo with tails over his customary filth-colored tunic and breeches. He was pulling on a pair of white cotton gloves, making them substantially less white in the process.
"Oh, Gary, please tell me this isn't what it looks like."
Hubert said,
"The master is training me to be his butler."
"Butler," Gary said. "I'm training him to be my butler."
"Yeah," Martin said.
"That's what it looks like."
"The master says that if I can prove my worth and loyalty, he may teach me magic. In the meantime, he's paying me a fine wage."
"And working for me will be a lot more pleasant than his previous job."
"Indeed,"
Hubert said.
"After I'm finished helping the master get dressed, I'm to sort his underwear, culling out any pairs that are too damaged to continue using."
Gary laughed.
"Yeah, okay, Hubert. Later on, we're going to have a conversation about butler-master confidentiality. Why don't you hand me my robe, then go get to work on breakfast? Martin, would you like Hubert to make you anything?"
"Would I like for Hubert to make food for me to eat? No. No, thank you."
Hubert said,
"Very good. I know which black robe would the master prefer to wear today?"
Gary said,
"You pick one. I trust you."
Hubert reached into the closet and grabbed one from the middle of a cluster of identical black robes, then handed it to Gary.
"Is this one to your liking, sir?"
"Yes, thanks. That'll be all, Hubert."
Hubert bowed deeply and left the room. Gary sat down on the foot of the bed and started threading a pair of Levi's on over his skeletal prosthetic leg.
"You've hired a man to help you dress yourself?" Martin asked. "That's got to be the laziest thing I've ever heard."
"Not at all. I've gone to the trouble of hiring a man to help me dress. You haven't gotten around to that yet. It looks like you could use the help. What the hell happened to your robe?"
Martin looked down at his shredded, tattered robe, still shedding sequins every time he moved.
"I was attacked by birds. We'll discuss that later. Gary, what you're doing to Hubert, it's not right."
"I'm giving him a job. Look, he brought up the idea of learning magic from me. You saw me telling him that it wasn't going to happen. I got to thinking about how desperate he seemed to find a better line of work, and it occurred to me that I couldn't make him a wizard, but I could come up with something better than being a dung sifter. But, hey, maybe I'm wrong. If you think he'd be better off in the dung pile, or the dung fields, or the siftery, wherever it is they do the sifting, feel free to go fire him."
"I'm not going to fire him, but this doesn't sit well with me."
Gary pulled on his black robe as he and Martin made their way from the bedroom back to the living room. As they emerged from the hallway and the kitchen came into view, they saw Hubert closing the door to the freezer, holding a frozen breakfast burrito, still in its plastic wrapper. He pulled on the wrapper's flat, heat-sealed end with both hands. Gary said,
"Hubert, don't bother unwrapping it. Just put a hole in the wrapper, heat it up, and put the whole thing on the plate."
"Yes, master."
Hubert tugged again at the wrapper, straining from the exertion, then lifted the wrapper to his mouth and bit a hole in its end. Martin noticed dark smudges on the wrapper where it had been touched by Hubert's hands and lips.
"So," Gary asked, "what brings you to my home? I don't remember inviting you over."
"I'm calling an emergency meeting."
"Cool. When and where?"
"Here. Any second now."
Convenient. I don't remember agreeing to that.
You didn't. I'll explain when everyone's here. I wouldn't have pulled a stunt like this if it weren't important.
Martin held up his left hand, palm upward.
Nomita Grupo Kvin.
A glowing orb appeared in Martin's hand. He said,
okay. Gary's decent and it's safe. Come on over.
In quick succession, Tyler, Jeff, and Roy appeared, all floating in midair with their legs pulled up protectively and their wands and staffs